Oh, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And Bruce, how's it going today? What's going on with you? And you got something for us to look at?
I do. I just found this FAQ. Let me grab the number. It was, I think it's actually in the next batch. So I'll go to the next link here. It's 389. Looks like an interesting one. And I read it probably a while ago. Here we go. So let me grab the link. And I was thinking, since we are normally in this time of year, in the season of elections, and I imagine there's some parts of the country that are having, you know, minor elections, it kind of always has to do with the choice and where our real choices are. So I thought, well, that might be a good theme, is just the topic of choice. So anyway, so let me post that in the chat window. As soon as I get the chat window going here, and there it is. And it's question 389 in the Foundation for A Course in Miracles FAQs. And it starts out with this sort of quick summary. Could the separation of the ego just be natural learning devices? So this apparently involves choice. I haven't read it for a while. It's probably been several years since I've read this FAQ. But should we give it a go?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay.
That's a really good question.
It's a four-parter that has four kind of related questions, and then there's three paragraphs, and we could expand from there, of course. I'll go ahead and read the expanded question, which has four parts, A, B, C, and D. The first one is A, according to A Course in Miracles, God is okay and we are not okay. Very similar to the biblical point of view. Sin of Adam, etc. We have God who is always right on the one hand and deluded, deteriorated mankind on the other. The old religious cliche. And then B, we are not we at all. We are ego, and ego is bad, unreal, does not exist at all. And so we do not exist. Ego is illusion, and so we're an illusion. But who is deluded? The mind of the Son of God is? And then why does that mind prefer to abide in illusion? It doesn't like truth. It doesn't endure truth. And then C, these are all kind of related questions, yeah. It seems to me that the Course wants to blame every natural human thing, like love, relationships, the drive to know things, to ask questions, to explore. All these things are the ego's things, bad things, they do not even exist. What is this powerful monster ego that, although it does not exist, holds all of humanity in its grasp, and even God can do nothing about it? That's the C part. And then lastly, the fourth D part of this question is, can it be that the separation is a part of the natural process of the Son of God's evolvement and conceived by God purposely? And ego is just a natural thing and not opposed to God. It's written, quote, the body is just a learning device, unquote. Maybe the ego is just another learning device.
Wow. I think I know who wrote this question. I don't really, but,
oh, okay. But
I've heard this same argument, and really, honestly, all these things you just read, this question, really is not a question at all, is it?
No. There's statements, you know, and then the Course is very, you know, gently emphatic about that from a number of places, including at least one appearance in the manual that, you know, that suggests that, I'm not sure there are others, directly or indirectly, that suggest that the things that we think of as our questions, more often than not, are really just veiled statements that are posing as questions. So, anyway.
Yeah. And you know, I've heard all these questions before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, isn't this just, could it be possible that we were right all along? You know, really, kind of. That's kind of what all these questions say, is it could be possible that we are right all along, and this whole idea that this ego bad and God good is really just a big ruse, and yeah, very interesting. So,
well, of course, it presupposes that there is such an idea of badness or sin or evil. And I was actually synchronistically, since you know everything seems to connect everything else, because it's all one thing. Just talking about this a few days ago with the concept of sin or evil, and then the original Aramaic word for that, according to a biblical scholar that I'd listened to years ago, is actually unripe. So the word in Aramaic that was translated in the, what we think of as the Christian Bible was actually meant unripe, and not the sin or the evil that we think of today as being something you know, worthy of scorn or derision or hatred or you know, disgust or whatever. You know, all of the aversion kinds of emotions and thoughts that we usually associate with, you know, the word evil or sin kind of thing. So anyway, I think that's really interesting, because you wouldn't go up to a kindergartner and say, you know, you have no understanding of calculus, you must be evil. You know, you just say, well, no, unripe is probably a better term, right? You just haven't got to that yet.
And, well, yeah. I think unripe is really a good word for that. In fact, I had not heard that.
Yeah.
I think it's much, much more accurate, actually, is mm-hmm. unripe. And also, sin in many languages, and even in Hebrew language, sin means without. There's actually a letter in the Hebrew language, I think, that is sin. Is pronounced sin, and of course it's not the same meaning, but it means without.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, in a lot of languages, it's interesting. It means it's lacking something.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've heard the missing the mark, which certainly is more you know, dispassionate and objective than the identity crisis version that you usually get from formal religion anyway, whether it's Christianity or otherwise. Interesting, isn't it? Do you want to read the first paragraph of the answer that's provided?
Sure, absolutely. Let me
see.
Over there. Okay.
Okay.
My eyes are a little flaky this morning, so but I got, you know, that's one thing that's wonderful about a computer. You can enlarge things just instantly. You can
zoom it in,
make it really, you can even get a little magnifier and put on there and actually magnify everything. It's so good.
Yeah.
All right. So it seems as if the Course and Jesus are saying the negative things about all of us that you state, but they are not. We are. Okay. So this is how the reversal, the Course, you don't even actually see it or know it, but it's actually true. You know, we're the ones who are thinking that the Course is saying these things. Mm-hmm. And it's coming from our twisted minds to, you know, believe that what Jesus is saying in the Course is all these negative things. And it's just amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Course is simply trying to help us get in touch with all the false beliefs we hold about ourselves. But these certainly do not represent how Jesus views us. According to the Course, in reality, we are more than okay. We are perfect. And there's a whole bunch of references from the Course about that. But we are the ones who keep denying that we are. The Course, unlike the Bible, is very clear that sin is not real. Again, we are the ones who keep insisting with the ego that sin is real. The Course does not say that we are the ego, but rather we have chosen to identify with the ego, which is not who we are. The Course also does not assert that the ego is bad. The ego says the ego is bad in order to have us take it seriously. And although we are not the ego, we believe we are, and so we think we are bad or sinful. Again, the ego's view of us is certainly not Jesus's view of us. He is trying to help us see what we believe and what accompanies it, so we can decide whether we want to continue believing it. But he takes none of it seriously, for he knows none of it is real. So a bunch of stuff, and there's a bunch of quotes from the course that are listed here, but I wasn't going to go through and read them all because it would have been confusing, I think. I would have been
confused. Yeah, anyway. Thank you for reading that and in its entirety, because I think that paragraph does well, you know, as a whole, and gives it a really good perspective that encompasses, you know, the depth and breadth of that answer, which really is that, you know, nothing happened, and kind of gets back to the almost a cliche from the course, is that, you know, there is no world. The central thought the course attempts to teach is that the world being a projection of a you know, misguided mind, not an evil, sinful, wicked one, but you know, just one that isn't ripe enough to, you know, hasn't evolved or expanded or extended enough to encompass all of creation, and therefore seems to believe that creation has been fragmented. You know, it's looking at a part of something. Anything that's partial appears to be incomplete, but that's a misperception, because we have an incomplete or unripe perception of things, and that in that seeming incompletion or partiality is the whole astonishingly absurd and horrifying, fearful perception, misperception that we have about ourselves and everyone else, because we think there is such a thing as everyone else. There is no else. There is no other. As physicist John Wheeler says, there's no out there out there. Ideas don't leave their source. There is just one being, one essence, one spirit. And we, in our silly minds, not evil, sinful, or wicked, as Ken Wapnick likes to remind us, there's none of that in truth. It's just silly that we believe that differences could have possibly happened. And so, having appeared to have taken that seriously, we, through the mechanism of projection, which was also a tool for this deluded mind, not casting any aspersions or any judgments on that, as this paragraph suggests, because the course doesn't make those judgments. It merely wants to have us see that we are judging and condemning ourselves and each other by believing that it was possible. And therefore, if we believe it's possible, then we must have done something, apparently, and this is just an appearance, just in a dream, to have coped with that uncopable idea that this was possible. And so we made up a world to hide out in. We made up an entire cosmos of space and time and form as a dream to attempt to escape from our minds, which, of course, is impossible. And along with that, we made up a whole arena of projection so that we could have good and bad. We could have the holy and the unholy. We could have the chosen and the unchosen as a coping mechanism or an escape strategy to avoid dealing with this unthinkable thought that we could have pulled off, you know, thrown God under the bus and, you know, sticking it to oneness, basically. and yet that is impossible. But we don't want to. We're so invested in the little self that we made, which appears to have a persona and this little poster child body. I think, in my deluded state, in my unripe state, that there's this cartoon character named Bruce Rawls. And I think that there's other ones named Lynn Johnson and whoever else is listening. And yet I know, as I think everyone truly does know in their heart of hearts, within the spiritual depth of their being, that this is impossible and just hilariously, outrageously funny in truth. But that's not where we find ourselves most of the time. So we need to be compassionate with ourselves as we, as you know, to use Ken Wapnick's metaphor, you know, climb the ladder home of of going back to the mind, reeling in our projections, forgiving our belief that this was possible, you know, seeing that those questions that we keep asking from that separated appearance in the mind are really just statements that were intended to continue promote and foment the propaganda of separation. And having seen that, we can gently release our white-knuckled grip on our judgments and return to where we never left in the mind and see that we've been home all along, you know, just like Dorothy and Wizard of Oz, you know, I was just dreaming all this fantastical stuff, you know, talking scarecrows and tin men and flying monkeys and all the whole gamut of stuff that, you know, we terrified ourselves with, but it just wasn't true. It was basically an amazing dream. So the practical part of it now is just we just need to look at the trees throwing apples and the flying monkeys and the, you know, whatever metaphors seem to be coming at us and realize, okay, we are the producers, directors, choreographers, and certainly authors of the screenplay, you know, and our signatures on every page of this thing. And if we just look down at the script and see our name on it, we realize, okay, well, I made this up to look like a question, but it's really a statement that says that this horrific, fearful, frightening movie actually is happening. You know, not even that it happened and it's over, but it seems to be actually happening, and I can give myself, you know, ample and countless examples of that, because I can when I'm done with this conversation, I can get up and I can get breakfast and I can, you know, walk through what appears to be a house and I have this fellow actor whose name I have given as Nancy, and she appears to be a separate person that I've lived with for almost a quarter of a century, and we've had these adventures, and we know all these other people, and you know, it just goes on and on and on. But it seems so real. But in moments of sanity, I think if we all just, you know, look for the little glimpses of light through the chinks in our ego's armor, so to speak, we have these little moments where we realize, what if this is just a massive, highly convincing, you know, Oscar award winning beyond, you know, plus, holographic movie of cosmic proportions that is part of the ego's, this deluded, unripe, immature self strategy to keep us enthralled, but it can be turned around. And here's the pragmatic part, by using every single thing that seems to happen in this dream as a way of getting back to the mind. And that becomes, instead of our judgment prison, it becomes our forgiveness classroom. And that's, I think, our way out of the quagmire. So
yes, exactly. Very clear. And you know what? One of the things that I noticed from reading the question and the answer was that something that all of us do. I don't know anyone who has actually just jumped into the course and given up all their other beliefs, given up all their other thoughts about what is, given up their new age magical thoughts, and we have a lot of new magical thoughts, and or Christian magical thoughts,
sure.
Or magical thoughts that we developed over the years through our experience with the world and with the church and with God and all of God's representatives, who are just absolutely the kind of people God would pick to represent Him. Like, you're just great. Like, you know, I don't know, Alex Jones and, you know, maybe Billy Graham and Desmond Tutu. And, you know, I mean, they're anyone that we look at and say, oh, they're telling me the truth about God, telling me the truth about what I am. And, you know, we listen to these stories and, you know, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, the Pope or Mother Teresa or Gandhi or Ramana Maharshi or whoever it is that I'm listening to, if I believe what they're telling me is that I'm real. The world is real. That God has abandoned me. I can get God to come back if I act a certain way or look a certain way or do certain things. You know, these are all beliefs that are ingrained in our personality, our persona, and these beliefs are hindering us from being able to really understand what Jesus is saying, because I can't have both. So, you know, I can't have God loves me and God wants his will for me is perfect happiness if I have sticking in the back of my mind, you know, God's a real jerk and he put me in this hell and now I have to deal with all these difficulties and I have to work and I have to eat and I have to, you know, all these terrible things that are going on in my life. And it's all because God did it. You know, you can't have both. You can't have both. And so, you know, and this is, you know, I've done it myself over the years, you know, dragged in. Oh, yeah, but, you know, I don't believe in reincarnation. Jesus says it's not true. However, I was, you know, Cleopatra's nursemaid. You know, I was, you know, we still want to believe our thinking and have somehow or the other have it merge with the Course in Miracles. You know, and have somehow the Course in Miracles is going to have, oh, yeah, it's going to give me, you know, psychic abilities and or, you know, whatever it is that we think. And if you think that you're going to achieve something through studying the Course and it is not what you achieve is that you disappear and there is no more ego personality involved. You know, that's really the aim here. The aim is not to make us be a certain thing. The aim is to make us not be what we think we are and remember the truth of who we are.
I would just suggest a slight modification of what you said. I would think that the aim of A Course in Miracles is not to eliminate or get rid of the ego. And it has a personality and its poster child body or any of that. It's really more to gently release our mind's grip on the idea that persona has any reality and therefore any value. And so it's because, you know, if we can let go of the extreme value that we've put on the things of the world, not that we don't have preferences as you know personas, but if we can just kind of watch what goes through our mind and just like we're watching a movie and say, oh well, that character that I'm watching on the screen is not my real identity, even though we have in a phenomenal way identified with that, we can undo that identification by forgiving ourselves for having made it up. And I think that's the very gradual and ultimately peaceful process that gives not only real hope, but a sense of growing calm and ease to our lives, no matter what appears to be going on in it. Because we realize that the life that we're seeing in this dream drama is not the real being that we are. And we're replacing the false identity with the real identity. We're not doing it. It's just falling away because we're letting the light through the cracks that we allow.
Yes.
in the curtain that we've put up there, the cloud, whatever metaphor you want to use, there's plenty in the Course that, you know, the feather that, you know, is really, we can brush aside, you know, as that sort of thing. But all those apparent barriers that we've erected in mind are just imaginary. And if we just look at each special relationship we have with our bodies, with our personas, with the thoughts that go through our mind that seem to be motivated by what's in it for me at the expense of anyone else, and we can gently begin to question and even, you know, not in any kind of derisive way, but just gently laugh at how crazy it is that we could have, you know, made such an elaborate hoax for ourselves that is this dream drama, and begin to not take it seriously by seeing the shared interest, that the sameness. I love how Ken Wapnick keeps coming at this over and over again from so many different angles and different examples, that if we can see that we're all the same and question every little bit of specialness, that is the choice the ego always makes, which basically leads directly, you know, with a thud back into the, you know, the bottom of the ladder, and we land with a thud in the dumpster full of the trash, and and that dumpster, so to speak, is the, you know, the belief in and sin and evil, that you know, we did something wrong, that was possible. Yes. Well, the world of action and choice ultimately, you know, as we've conceived it or misconceived it, really is predicated on the idea that it was possible to choose against perfect oneness. It was possible to make up a dream in our mind where separation from that perfect oneness and separation from each other was possible. So I think the perfect oneness is such an abstract concept for most of us that really isn't too pragmatic, you know, unless you have an incredibly adept devotional mind, I think. But the separation from each other, that is such a wonderful and fertile, classroom for our forgiveness exercises, because we can look at every single thing that we, you know, evaluate in terms of the what's in it for me versus, you know, what's in it for the other person, and see that our separate interests are always at war with the shared interest that the Holy Spirit holds out to us as the forgiveness classroom. And the shared interest ultimately being manifestations or reflections of the really, truly one shared interest of let's go home together from this dream. Let's wake up from the an astonishingly absurd and ultimately silly idea that separation from each other and from ultimately perfect oneness was possible. So if we can see those in every moment, those instances where we want to make grievances real, we want to, you know, feel victimized, we want to be upset, but it's never for the reason we think, as Workbook Lesson 5 reminds us. And just look at that with tremendous compassion for ourselves and each other, we realize that the only person that needs to make that choice is me, because in truth, if there's only one of us, then all I have to do is listen to the Holy Spirit's interpretation of the dream, which is this too is a forgiveness moment. This too is a perfect forgiveness classroom. Every specific thing that crosses my path is a way for me to look at the little ticker tape going along in my mind that is the ego's, you know, not so funny you know, dirge track that's going across the bottom of the screen that says, you know, be afraid, be very afraid, you know, be guilty, be very guilty. You blew up, you know, you sabotaged and damaged perfect oneness, and now you're paying for it, and, you know, run. You know, it's this fugitive from unconscious guilt approach that the ego always takes, but tries to cover up. And make it well, it's this other person or this other situation's fault. It's the fact that you know, I'm living in a country where there's this divided political spectrum and scenario. It's I'm living in a world where there's environmental toxins, or I'm living in a house where I don't always agree with my life partner, or you know, I mean, you could take it from the sublime to the ridiculous, and anywhere from in between, and you can say, well, gee, you know, there's always something in this world that we've made up that can appear to take us out of our mind and keep us enthralled in the whole grievance thought system. But it's all just silly, isn't it? We all have the opportunity at every moment to let go of that if we just gently look at whatever's in front of our face and say, "Well, here's my forgiveness classroom." And I'm reminded of about a week and a half ago, I had a video conversation with Gary Renard and Cindy Laura Renard. They both have two new books. Cindy's has been out for a month or two now, I think, maybe more than that. And Gary's should be out in just a few days, actually, within the next week or so. And you know, they're both about getting back to the mind, looking at the contents of the mind. They're different emphases and approaches. And you mentioned, you know, the reincarnation thing. Gary's new book, which I'm very much looking forward to reading, is all about the there's a half a dozen lifetimes where Jesus and Buddha shared an imaginary dream life together. Just as Lynn, you and I appear to be sharing an imaginary dream life, you know, in the same time frame, and we've our physical bodies' paths have crossed, you know, two or three times, I guess, in the last decade. And you know, but all that is just a part of an elaborate script, isn't it, that we've made up to convince ourselves, wow, this thing is real. And you know, it's the body, I call it the poster child of the ego, because that's such a perversive Freudian slip, a pervasive instrument, you know, a propaganda machine for convincing us that, you know, that the evil, sinfulness and wickedness is real, because we think that as long as there's something that's separate, that has flaws and physical symptoms and issues with other parts of the dream, that we think that's real. We think that, you know, we pulled it off. But all it takes is just a moment of gentle reflection to see that, you know, wait a minute, what if this really is just a massive dream? Then we don't have to take the badness or the sinfulness that the ego wants us to evaluate the seemingly separate self seriously. We don't have to take that seriously, as the last paragraph says. Did you want to comment on any of that? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely I did. And I'm just listening and enjoying your comments and your take on this. Just to go back to a little moment about the reincarnation thing, you know, it's because all things happened at once.
Mm-hmm.
Everything happened in that tiny mad idea instant, and after which not a note in heaven's song was missed. So this conversation we're having right now happened in that tiny mad idea at that very instant. The conversation that I had, you know, 1,000 years ago with the Buddha, or, you know, 10,000 years ago with, you know, my neighbor in the cave, you know, you know, that all happened at once. It's all happening right now, this very instant. So yeah, because the mind, the ego mind, the human mind is linear in its thinking. Everything has to, one thing follows another. You're on that little horizontal train where you're just going chugga 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 choo 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 on the train through all the different experiences. But if you were to, as Jesus suggests to us in the Course, go from that horizontal thinking into vertical thinking, where all of a sudden now you are above the battleground, you are in a place where you can look at what appears to be happening and recognize that it's all laid out in front of you like a plane of heaven. You can see everything, you know, not heaven, but you know what I'm saying, that you can see everything from that above the battleground point of view, and notice that everything that has ever occurred is just the same mistake over and over and over and over and over and over and over forever. That is how our lives are. We live a life where we make the same mistake from the moment our eyes open in the morning till the moment our eyes close at night. And actually, the only place where we are not living in this dream body, dream world, in our mind, in our thinking, is in our dreams when we're sleeping. Uh-huh. You know, this is why people long to sleep. Oh my God, you know, let me get some rest. Let me get out of here. You know, let me get out of here where I'm having to, you know, look at things and compare things and figure things out and try things. And, you know, let me get out of here before, you know, so I can get some rest. You know, and we go to sleep and we dream. And in our dreams, we have freedoms that we don't have in our life. We also have dangers that we don't have in our life. We have a lot of things in our dreams that don't occur in our regular earthly life because they maybe seem impossible or whatever. But it's all the same. It's in our mind. It is not really happening here. And so, and it never did really happen. It's just a thought that we have that it is happening. And so everyone has opportunity at any moment to go into that vertical thinking simply by asking their inner teacher, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it, Jesus, to help you, to show you the truth about what, you know, do I want to see what I denied? Because it's the truth. And if I can see what I denied, and what I denied is that the Christ is the real truth and reality of everything. So the Christ mind, the Christ that I am, and the Christ that you are, and the Christ that my desk is, and the Christ that the sky is, and everything is a reflection, basically, of the Christ mind, because there's nothing else. You know, there's no world out here. You know, there's nothing here that is separate from heaven. It's impossible. You know, I mean, the impossibility of disturbing heaven, killing God, making our own universe, you know, for, you know, billions of years or billions of however long we want to call it. You know, it all happened at the same time. It's all done and over with. You can't change a thing. You know, that's the other thing that people go into this hopes that, yes, okay, so if I do this course, then I'm going to actually change the dream. I'm going to be able to change the dream. And no, you cannot change the dream as long as you're dreaming. You're still dreaming. It's still an error. You might change, you know, a little tidbit, but I don't think so, because I think that, again, nothing... God put a limit on our ability to miscreate. And this is it.
Yeah, we're quarantined, so to speak.
Yeah. So, you know, we're not going to be creating a new scenario tomorrow or we're not going to be continue to be making these things. What we see is what we get. I mean, basically, this is it. So, you know, the challenge is to see heaven here, to see the Christ in my brother, to see heaven in his eyes, you know, to join with the thinking of the universe rather than thinking with my small, pitiful, personal thoughts. You know, that's what happens is you shift from the mind of the limited and small ego to the unlimited knowing of the universal mind, and you see that you do laugh. You can't help but laugh when you see how silly you have been and how difficult you made it for yourself. But also, you cannot help then but to have compassion for the brother, seeming brother, who doesn't see this. And who is in deep fear and has concerns about, you know, every part of their life, because they don't know that everything is planned. They don't know that it's all taken care of. You know, the greatest freedom that we have as students of A Course in Miracles is the knowing absolutely and for certain that I cannot change this illusion. I can't make it a kinder illusion. I can't make it a better illusion. I can't rearrange the furniture in the illusion. It's not going to make any kind of difference at all to my experience, because no matter how kind the illusion is, the ego will always experience it as torture.
I would also add to that that, in fact, maybe even you know, a greater feeling of peace can come from, if we really ponder it, the fact that we can't, as dream figures, change reality. you know, Bruce and Lynn cannot change perfect oneness, which is really a great thing, because if we could as egos, then, you know, then sin might have been possible, you know. Then the error that we've turned into, this horrific, you know, guilt-ridden, you know, mind-shredding, just downright awful experience. That is really not possible in truth. But because our minds are so powerful and we believe that it was possible to have pulled that off, we can experience, you know, tremendous angst and anguish and you know, just a tortured existence. But that's not the reality of it. I couldn't help but laughing at it. You know, a few moments ago you mentioned cave, the word cave, and I was flashing on my wife loves to watch the Home and Garden TV channel, HGTV, all the shows about people in different parts of the world, a lot of them in this country, you know, looking for a new place to live with their, you know, families and so forth. And I was thinking, well, what if that was filmed, you know, a few millennia ago, you know, and and what if the HGTV channel was you know, actually filmed in the prehistoric eras, and the realtors of that era would go around saying, well, here's you know, dank cave estates, and we're going to show you a few properties there, kind of thing. But that's kind of what we're doing in this world, is, you know, we're taking these abysmal situations. And I'm not, you know, trying to diminish that, because I actually watch some of the shows, especially the international ones. It's kind of fun, like, to, you know, get my vicarious travel in, you know, for this particular planet. But and I do enjoy travel, and also, you know, seeing, you know, what other people are doing in the world and enjoying that process. But if we could just kind of, you know, look at that as well, I'm really, you know, taking this dark, abysmal reality and just trying to dress it up. You know, previously I've used the metaphor of falling in the dumpster, and I think that's a helpful one. You know, we're trying to, you know, make a silk purse out of a sow's ear here. You know, we're really trying to take what Ken Wapnick says, you know, is a perfectly miserable situation, and the course is not trying to make us more miserable. It's trying to help us gently look at the fact that we are miserable here, and it does that, especially if you, as you go through the text and the rest of the other two volumes in the supplements, and realize that the general format is, look at the ego for what it purports to be, for the insistent, emphatic, loud lies that it shares with compassion, but just look at them. And I think that's where it's so important that we just look. We just have to just observe the contents of our mind in a dispassionate way, and gently see, you know, that's not working out for me. That belief that evil, sinful, wickedness, and badness, which is getting back to this FAQ, is if we believe that that's possible, we're playing into the ego's hand, which is the self that we made up, that proclaims itself is evil, sinful, wicked, bad, and otherwise, you know, guilt-ridden, because that's the only thing it knows. And anything that it does is basically propaganda to support that erroneous premise. So if we can look at that objectively and calmly by metaphorically taking Jesus's hand, the Jesus that authored A Course in Miracles, not so much the one that is talked about as a historical physical figure in the formal religion of Christianity, but the essence of that, I use the word Christ, that awareness that is outside of the dream of space and time, just as we are that identity and truth, then we begin to make the forgiveness process easier and easier, because we see, you know, there was nothing worth you know, drawing our swords for, or put, getting our hand on the nuclear launch button, you know, in our mind. We don't have to be upset by what's happening in a massive dream, no matter how massive it seems. Right?
Well, yeah, and you know, it's real interesting to me as you're talking and I'm listening and I'm thinking, you know, one of the things that I've really noticed is not trying to throw shoot arrows at people here, but one thing I've really noticed is that a lot of times when people start studying A Course in Miracles and get into the course, they become very aggressive toward other students of A Course in Miracles and have this whole idea of, you know, righteousness and rightness and, you know, and even to the point of citing. Here, I'm going to let my cat out of this room because he's in and out. It's like, anyway, but anyway, you know, people get on to the course and, you know, they either pick, you know, I think, you know, Ken Wapnick is right, or I think Robert Perry is right, or I think, you know, Marianne Williamson is right, or, you know, we get these ideas, we start worshiping these characters who are
in the People's Front of Judea instead of the Judean People's Front, you mean?
Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, we who you would think will have an answer as to why this world is so insane, have an answer as to what we can do about this insane world, have a practice of forgiveness that has been given to us very clearly, and have a, you know, 365 lessons that are there to help us to experience this this life of freedom. And you know, we start arguing about, you know, what words mean and how, you know, instead of taking this and saying, here's the key to freedom, here's the key to the prison, open the gate and get out, we say, all right, you guys, we're just going to lock this place up and we're going to sit here and argue until one of us gets it right, and it's better be me. So, and we treat each other so poorly and have, you know, I mean, it's just like anybody else, any other thing in the world, except for, again, we have the key to the prison door. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't say that really about any other spirituality, you know, unless it contains deep work of looking at the inner being and thinking about our motives and our thoughts and why and how we do what we do. You know, if you're not contemplating your life and contemplating what you believe, and you're just going again, like I said earlier, with whatever seems to be showing up in the spiritual buffet line, or you know, whatever you picked up in your childhood, you know, none of us are right, and all of us have the opportunity to not be right. We don't have an opportunity to be right, because the ego will never be right, no matter what. What we truly are is always right, but.
but also left, yeah, but, because there's no duality.
right, because there is there's nothing else. But the thing is that, you know, instead of first off, because it really is a self-study course. It's not a course that is that was made to be taught in classrooms or through. I mean, we do. Workshops and things like that, because we want to express our understanding of what Jesus is telling us. But there's no one in this world, and there never can be and never will be, who is an expert on the Course in Miracles, because if you are an expert, you've come to the place where you no longer even need a body. And you are like Jesus. The point of the Course in Miracles is to remove the obstacles to the point where we are the Christ. we can walk on water, we can move mountains, we can heal the sick and raise the dead. And I'm not saying this that you were going to go out and start doing those things. I'm saying that there is no reason why we couldn't do those things when we know that this is an illusion and that the illusion is a product of our own thinking. So, you know, it's like you can rearrange the molecules. You can rearrange the atoms. You can do anything with this. And Jesus himself, he said he did that. He fabricated a body for when he needed to have a body, when he wanted to communicate with people. But that was not his natural state. And that is not our natural state either. But we don't know that like Jesus knew it. Why did Jesus know it? Because he accepted the correction of his mind, which we call the atonement, and allowed his mind to think with the universal mind instead of his own pitiful, meaningless, private thoughts. That is what happened to Jesus. It could happen to you and me. And in fact, it will eventually, at some point, happen to everyone. Not because we're all bound for glory, but because it's the truth of what we are. And you can only deny the truth for some time. I mean, you can't deny the truth forever. So I'm going to read the next paragraph. If we remember the question, which was, I'm all confused about the Course. Ego bad, God good, what does it mean?
Lynn, before you do, I'm just going to comment one real quick comment. You started a sentence a few minutes ago of, there's no one in the world who, and I was thinking, well, you could actually shorten that sentence to just simply, there's no one in the world. Yeah. In the sense that the oneness that we think we lost or threw under the bus or trashed or messed up somehow, and then we feel unconsciously guilty about, which for no particular reason, because it's not true, that oneness doesn't exist in the world, but it can be reflected in the world as a choice of teachers. So anyway, so the oneness is beyond the world, just as we, in truth, all as one being, are outside the dream of time and space. We are larger than the universe, all of us. We're more than the nothingness, ultimately, that the universe represents as a concept in our mind. So anyway.
Right, and we'll never, ever, ever know what we are as long as we believe that we're something else.
Exactly, exactly.
There's no reason to believe, to think of anything else if you think you already know. And that's the other point that I was making earlier. Yeah. Is you have to give up your belief that you know.
Right. And that's why we need to be guided and why the Course emphasizes not only shared interest, but following the awareness that is greater than the little s self that we think we are, whether we call it Holy Spirit or Jesus of the Course or our inner kindness teacher. It doesn't matter what label we put on it, but we have to be willing to accept the idea that that little lowercase s, seemingly separate self, is not wrong in an evil, sinful, or wicked sense, but just a silly, misguided, or an erroneous. I love how earlier throughout the text, actually, of the Course in Miracles and elsewhere, it distinguishes between sin and error. An error is something you can correct, and that's such a relief because that means there is an awareness within us that can simply gently look at the dream and say, "This is a dream." You don't have to get upset about a dream because it is not real. That doesn't mean we don't do things in the world that are, as we've talked about many times, magical, that seem to help, get us through our fears and our anxieties. But ultimately, the real learning is seeing that the dream is not real and no infraction, no crime has been committed. There's no need to be a fugitive from the reality that is our real self that is really symbolized by these ideas we call Holy Spirit, Jesus, inner kindness teacher, whatever, that represent a choice in the mind to let go of our dream identities and be at peace again. So anyway, please go on.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And yes, you make excellent points on all those. Something, let me see here. Okay. Ben Gilberti posted something from Eckhart Tolle today. And it says, and this is so perfect, the ego isn't wrong, it's just unconscious.
Yeah.
When you observe the ego in yourself, you are beginning to go beyond it. Don't take the ego too seriously. When you detect egoic behavior in yourself, smile. At times, you may even laugh. How could humanity have been taken in by this for so long? Above all, know that the ego isn't personal. It is who you are. If you consider the ego to be your personal problem, that's just more ego.
Great reminders. Thank you, Ben. Ben's posted a lot of really cool stuff on Facebook over the years, too.
Absolutely. I love Ben Gilberti. And, you know, he used to teach here. I keep trying to get him to come back.
Oh, okay.
Well, but but yeah, there's some really good recordings of him in the archives.
Oh, okay.
Just really, really brilliant teaching. Yeah, he was one of those Prosperos guys like Suzanne Deakins and Robbie McEwen. That same organization. Anyway, so let me go back, go ahead and read the next paragraph. Okay. As to why the mind of the Son of God has chosen to abide in illusion, as compelling as that question seems to be, you are assuming that it is true, that we do abide here. And certainly that seems to be our experience. The Course in Jesus's position is that it's not true. But so long as we believe it is, he'll speak to us in the only language we allow ourselves to understand right now. And that's in text chapter 25, section 1, about the things that we think are real in a way that will lead us to understand that they are not. It is not that God can do nothing about the illusion, but rather that there is nothing to be done. There only seems to be much for us to allow to be undone. The Course passes no condemnation or blame against the inventions of the ego, all its questions and seeking and relationships. We are the ones who make the accusations. The Course merely attempts to help us see the consequences of our choices and beliefs, but it never attacks them, for that would mean they are real and have to be dealt with. It is only the ego that sees itself or tries to persuade us that it is big and powerful. And there's a reference to text chapter 22, section 5. You know, this is exactly what we've been saying. It never happened. Something that happens to me since I've been doing all this mind watching kind of frequently now is that I will be sleeping and dreaming. And in the dream, there's something that I have to do or have or be or something. And right when I realize that in my dream, I'm attempting to do something that I don't even understand, then I realize, oh, I must be dreaming. Because how could I be doing that, you know? And I wake up. Okay, that's a really good thing to me, because that means that when I'm dreaming in the quote unquote real world, and as I begin to recognize that what I'm expecting myself to know, to be, to do, to have, is not the reality of what I am, then, you know, I can give it up. I can say, this can't be real. This can't be true. Every time you have to invent something or figure something out or decide something, if you look at the criteria that you have to make your decision on, the things that you know about what is potentially going to happen in the future, the things that you understand about the world and the way that it works. If you began to recognize that those are just, you know, I was going to say a house of cards, really. But I don't want to laugh about that. But those are really, they're just made up circumstances, made up thoughts and ideas, imaginary. And the even the potential for changing the future by which I would have to make a plan. Now I would have to figure out what's going to happen, and I would have to make a decision about what is the best thing that could happen, or what do I really want to happen. All of that is just ludicrous. It's an absurd exercise, because it is saying that somehow or the other I can rearrange the dream. The fact is, and of course this is my perception of what the fact is, but it seems to be borne out over and over and over again. The fact is, I can't predict a damn thing. I have no idea. I can guess all day about what's going to happen next, and the only thing that's going to happen next is what's going to happen next. There's no way that I can change it or rearrange it, because again, it was script written long ago. It was over in an instant. So I'm not going to go in there and rearrange the stars or change the order of the universe. I can't do that, because it's a dream. All I can do in a dream is to wake up. Just like all I can do if I'm in the desert is to get out. There's no reason to stay where I'm not being served, and I'm not being my whole self. If I'm in a place where I have to pretend and make up stories and make up conversations and try to figure out what's going to happen, you know, these are all pressures that come onto a person when they think that somehow or the other they know, or they have information, or they have a desire. And, you know, give up desire, first off. You know, give up the idea that there's something that you want in this world, because it's not true. You may think that it's true, but it's not true. There's nothing in this world that you really want.
Yeah. I would also suggest that the Course doesn't ask us to give up anything. In fact, it's in a sense asks us to see that the only sacrifice that we appear to have made is to sacrifice our peace, and we don't have to sacrifice anything in the world, because if there is no world, how could anything, you know, how could a self that doesn't exist be giving up something that doesn't exist?
Exactly. It's just silly. It's silly.
Yeah. It doesn't ask for us to change our behavior in the world. That may or may not happen as a result of looking at the thoughts that the Course suggests that we look at, which is that the only real alternative is to go back to the mind, see that our choice for a divided, fragmented self, a seemingly separate self, has been the apparent cause of all of our imagined grief and woes, and that rearranging the deck chairs on a Titanic dream is not going to make us happy. Knock yourself out if you think that is if that's what helps you get out of your fear more quickly. You know, the Course doesn't, again, it's not never about behavior. It's always about looking at the mind. So it doesn't suggest in any way that we change our behavior. However, once we look, as you were suggesting, Lynn, that and seeing the consequences of the choices for making the dream and fixing things in the world and changing things in the world the big deal, and making that the emphasis of our life, then we get to see that just kind of like Charlie Brown every year, you know, when Lucy holds the football and yanks it away at the last moment and we land on our back with a whoop, you know, that the ego consistently has failed us. And that seemingly separate self that we've put so much investment in, trying to find, you know, As Ken Wapnick points out, you know, 1,000 homes that attempts to, you know, well, he's actually, I think, quoting from the course at some point in one of the audios I listened to, 1,000 homes that, you know, attempts to make. And these are all the special relationships that we think that, you know, whether it's a physical home or whether it's the home of our relationships in the world, where we think that it's this body and how it relates to other bodies, or this body and the amount of numbers in a bank account that are now just represented by ones and zeros in a computer somewhere, or whether it's you know, the state of the molecules in a holographic projection that seems to be, you know, what people call Bruce is this seemingly separate self goes through its life. You know, I mean, that, again, we need to be normal and not just, you know, pretend like that this is all going to go away. But if we kind of watch this elaborate dream that we've made up with a gentle smile and see, wow, this is just an incredibly elaborate hoax. And I can go through my day, do all the normal things that I would do regardless, but do it with a greater sense of kindness and compassion for myself and everyone that I meet, recognizing that I'm being compassionate to myself by being kind to whether it's a phone or a chair or a pen or a person, like those early workbook lessons suggest, you know, that we've given those things all the meaning that they have for us because we wanted to escape from an unconscious guilt that was unfathomable, but also unfounded. You know, it's unconscious but unfounded. I think those are the two words that help us get through this by looking at the projections we've made, and we don't need to attack anything because they're not real. You know, we seem to need to do things in the world, and it's a very appropriate that we respond in a, you know, kind-hearted and effective manner to what is going on. But we can do that. It's sort of like an independent variable. It's like an you know, in geometry, it's an independent axis. There's a y-axis in addition to the x-axis, which is the horizontal dream, but there's a y-axis. That I'm going to make a pun here, that asks why we are doing things in the world. And if we can look at the contents of our mind with that why, we can metaphorically rise above the battleground of the ego's strategy and realize that, you know, there is a way out of the labyrinth of the maze. And it's not by necessarily going through it, because at any given moment we can see the shortest route out. And sometimes that is actually just grabbing the rope from the helicopter that's hovering above us that we never noticed before, the rope ladder and climbing up that. and then, you know, but I think that's really those quantum forgiveness moments where we see, oh, wow, I don't have to see myself as stuck in this dream. I can experience fully, whether it's you know, the colleague I'm working with who's you know, is telling me that her mother is passing, and the appropriate response is, well, you know, I feel for you, you know, and to allow yourself to grieve and do all the normal things. But at the same time, and I know she realizes this too, is that, you know, that there's an awareness that that isn't the reality of her or her mother. You know, we're not these bodies, it seems big and powerful and persuasive, as this last paragraph we read suggests. But the magnitude of the dream gets compressed to zero once we take the hand that's being extended to us, or, you know, the rope ladder metaphorically of Holy Spirit's helicopter, and just say, hey, you know, there's a way of looking at the world that is gentle and actually almost amused at the insanity and the complexity that we've made of this labyrinthine mess. And we can afford to gently forgive ourselves and everyone that appears to be wandering around in this maze, and see that, you know, we're not stuck here at all. We're just having a dream. Edgar Allan Poe's has a quote, all that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. And something you said earlier when you're talking about your dreams, I was thinking, well, that's actually kind of cool. If anybody hasn't seen the movie Inception, That's a really cool movie about nested dreams, and I've seen it half a dozen times now. I actually bought the DVD because there's so much in it. But if anybody hasn't seen that one, that's kind of a fun one to look at the metaphors that are in the course. So, should I read the third paragraph?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. It says, now the Course is not insisting that we accept its particular symbolic myth of the origins of the world and the cause of our pain and unhappiness. And you do seem to have some pretty strong objections to its particular logic and arguments. And referring back to these four statements at the beginning of this FAQ, which were, you know, essentially, you know, to distill it, it's, I'm an ego and I have to fight myself. And, okay. So, and then I'll go back to the answer here. The Course says what it says quite emphatically and without compromise. And it is helpful to understand what it is saying in order to evaluate whether it speaks to you personally or not. But if it does not make sense to you, that is okay too. And there will be another path that uses other symbols that is more suited to your own particular needs. Interestingly, I was noticing when you were mentioning dream characters a while ago this morning, Lynn, you mentioned Ramana Maharshi, and I was thinking, well, yeah, it's important to not make idols of even the ones, you know, whether it's Ken Wapnick or Gary Renard or Nisargadatta or what, you know, doesn't matter. Every seeming separate self for us becomes either a teacher of God or a teacher of ego. And that's true of every seemingly separate individual. So it's all the purpose that we give to it, isn't it? Okay, I'll go on. This says, but it does not make sense to you. Okay, there's another path that will be suited to your particular needs. Okay, other teachings, including many New Age paths, speak of duality and the world as creations of God. I'll just share one example of that. It's in Conversations with God. and I like Neil Donald Walsh, don't get me wrong. I find that some of the ideas in those that I found interesting before I found the Course, I realized, well, that doesn't really get you out of the dream. So anyway, let's start that sentence over again. Other teachings, including many New Age paths, speak of duality in the world as creations of God and describe the soul as evolving and developing through its experiences in the world of form. If you resonate more to these teachings, it would be foolish for you to keep butting heads with the Course. It makes no claim for the universality of its form, only its content. In its own words, there is a Course for every teacher of God. The form of the Course varies greatly. So do the particular teaching aids involved. But the content of the Course never changes. Its central theme is always, God's Son is guiltless, and in his innocence is his salvation. And that's an all-inclusive innocence. And that's, you know, the depth and breadth of our classroom, isn't it? So know that peace will accompany you wherever you go, and trust that you will find what will serve you well on your path to God. What a gentle, open-ended and kind-hearted response this is, isn't it? I mean, because it basically is saying, you know, if this doesn't resonate with you, and of course, even in itself, in numerous places, says, you know, do not fight yourself. You know, if you're not ready, if things are unripe in your mind for a particular concept, whether it's from a particular teacher or teaching, such as, I'll just, you know, suggest like Ken Wapnick or A Course in Miracles. You know, some people say, well, I don't really, like hearing those audios or, you know, I've heard that from several people. Or I don't like the iambic pentameter of the Course or the fact that there's, you know, no female pronouns or, you know, there's so many ways to use the form. And you know, and again, if any of those things apply to you, this is not a personal attack. It's basically, it's an opportunity to look at the resistance that we have and to see how we all have this enormous resistance, and we can all afford to be really gentle and patient with ourselves and know that there's no way ultimately we can avoid reconnecting with that perfect innocence, and that everyone will be included in that. And there's a big clue right there, is that if we leave anyone or anything out, whether it's through special love or special hate, and special love is a way of excluding, even though it doesn't seem to be on the surface, that gives us an opportunity to to, you know, in a sense, accelerate our forgiveness classroom by taking more of the everyday experiences that cross our mind and turning it over to Holy Spirit and say, okay, let's look at this together, because if I look at this by myself, by my seemingly separate self, I'm gonna want to be right, but I'm not going to be happy, because I'm going to see this as the what's in it for me prison instead of the forgiveness classroom that is possible. So I imagine you have probably a few things to share on this too, Lynn, as we've been talking. Still there? Hello, Lynn.
I muted my mic. I'm sorry.
Okay. No problem. I do that too. Sometimes I forget. I looked at, the light's blinking on my headset.
Yeah, absolutely. I do, because some of the things that you were just saying and talking about the New Age paths and all the different things that, you know, we would rather believe or listen to. What I've noticed is that, here's another pointer, because it's pointing right at me, is that as we, it's a practice, I'm calling it burning bridges. Okay. All right. So, I used to, read Don Miguel Ruiz, and I'm really into that. I read the Celestine Prophecy. I was really into that. Deepak Chopra, really into that.
Check.
No, I mean, all these things I've looked at, I've followed, I listened to, I've practiced, I've done all these different things. And, you know, now that I think I'm getting a handle on, you know, what this Course in Miracles is telling me to do, you know, I'm going to, when someone says, oh, Deepak says that, I'm going to say, well, he doesn't really know, because it's not A Course in Miracles and the world is not real. And, you know, I'm looking at those same teachers that helped me along, that brought me into an awareness that I was going to be able to actually comprehend A Course in Miracles when I finally got into it. You know, I'm turning on them and saying, oh, well, you're no good anymore, because I have surpassed your teachings. Which, you know, I'm saying I do this because I do this. You know, I'll laugh at things I read. People will post stuff up on Facebook or whatever, and you know, it's their understanding of a certain teaching or a certain teacher, or even someone who has an understanding of A Course in Miracles that's different than mine. And, you know, I'm going to look at them and tell them how wrong they are and how stupid they are to believe those things. Because I forget so easily the years that I was worried and sad, afraid, vulnerable, seeking, not finding, and being in a lot of psychic pain. You know, that these, you know, Deepak helped me, you know Eckhart Tolle helped me, you know, and not saying anything about any of their teachings, just saying that I looked at them and I listened to them. Byron Katie, you know, all of them helped me come to a point where my mind was open enough that I could actually let what Jesus is saying in the Course in Miracles in. You know, I could actually open up and let that in. It softened me, it opened me, and it gave me hope. So for me to turn on them now, and anybody who's listening to them and saying, well, you know, forget about that because you got A Course in Miracles here. Ken Wapnick will tell you everything you need to know. You know, that is my arrogance. That it's ego arrogance, obviously. you know, is just another way of separating me from my brothers. Mm-hmm. When Jesus is telling us that, you know, that we are to look at our brother as the Christ, which means that we are to look at our brother as if he were fully awake and fully knowing and fully open and fully in connection with his divine. This is how Jesus is telling us to look at our brothers. Not like they're hopeless, psychotic losers. You know, that's not what Jesus is telling me to look at my brother as. And that's how he woke up. He woke up from looking at his brother and seeing the Christ in everyone he saw. He looked at Pontius Pilate and saw the Christ, not in spite of what he saw, but that was what he saw when he looked at the soldiers that were nailing him to a cross. He was not seeing horrible soldiers who were torturing people. He saw the Christ, and whatever was occurring in the illusion, in the ego, in the world to the body, had no bearing, was not even noticeable. It's like you're in a room and the television is playing and you're not paying any attention to it. It's going on, but it's not in your consciousness. That is how Jesus, I believe, lived his life. You know, once he saw the Christ and remembered God, he no longer saw the world as the solid thing that it appears to be to us. He saw it as, you know, completely whatever the reality of it is. You know, he saw the reality of it and was not fooled by the illusion anymore. And so, that's what he's asking us to do.
Yeah. Hey, I've got a quick story that I think we've got a couple of minutes. If you could spare a couple of minutes, and something you said reminded me of this. And first, a quick comment is I actually had an opportunity to interview Miguel Ruiz on community radio over a decade ago, and he's a wonderful person. I really enjoyed the short time I spent with him and a friend of his that was with him. Anyway, just a delightful heartfelt exchange, and we had a great time. But in terms of what you said, is, you know, kind of reminded me of a phrase that I heard a fellow named Jack Holland, who was basically a metaphysical teacher early in my studies as an adolescent, actually, back in mid to late 70s, when I was high school, college age, and he actually gave a talk where I grew up in Livermore, California, and my mom, who was also an avid student of metaphysics, said, "Hey, let's go hear him talk." And he gave a talk not far from where she lives now, and he was talking about how he had an opportunity to see the Dalai Lama. And this is, I had never really heard much about the Dalai Lama until I heard this talk. And he, you know, had been studying a lot of different things and wanted to know about mind control and, in particular, the Russian psychic experiments to influence things using mind control. Well, this has sort of come back into contemporary world events in a different form. But our government has had this program called MK Ultra and all this sort of thing. And even Bill Thetford was involved in a program that he was I'm diverging slightly, but anyway, there's a wonderful write-up on the ACIM.org website about in the archive section currently by Whit Whitman talking about how, you know, essentially what the Personality Assessment System, or PAS, that Bill Thetford as a consultant developed for the CIA, ironically was designed to show all the fragments of the ego's expression in the sense that it basically looks at all the different personality types and which ones are more likely to be reliable and you know, dedicated to doing the right thing under pressure. And so they were using that as a criteria for evaluating new hires into that organization. That's my understanding of it anyway. And which is fascinating. And at the same time, you know, the irony is that Carol Howe points this out in her book, Never Forget to Laugh. I'm digressing within a digression, as you probably noticed. But anyway, in Carol Howe's book, I finally got to meet Carol in Utah this last summer. And again, also a delight to hear her talk and share a bit with her. In her Never Forget to Laugh book, she points out how, you know, while it appeared that the CIA was, quote unquote, using Bill Thetford's expertise for, you know, whatever aims that they had. The truth was that, you know, the reality is that everyone the Holy Spirit has been using the CIA and Bill Thetford and everyone to within the context of the real purpose of the dream, which is to wake up, as a means to see the insanity of the ego, and we're all using it to wake up with. So that's not how she said it, but I'm paraphrasing tremendously there. But anyway, but it was kind of interesting. So meanwhile, back to the talk that Jack Holland gave and how he went to go see the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, India, years and years ago. This was, again, in the 70s era somewhere, several decades ago. And he was talking about how he wanted to know if, you know, the question that he posed to Dalai Lama is, you know, will the Russians be able to successfully use mind control techniques against the United States? And again, a contemporary question that's surfaced in a different way in the last year or so.
yes, but, it is.
But the commentary that the Dalai Lama had was very simple and sort of seemingly cryptic. He says, but very specific. He says, when you land in Athens, go and talk to a Mr. So-and-so who's the curator of this museum, the such-and-such museum in Athens, and look for such-and-such a volume by Plato, and there will be your answer. And it's like, well, wow, that's kind of, you know, elaborate and very specific answer. Well, and Jack Holland said, well, I'm not planning to go back through Greece. And, well, it turned out his plane was hijacked. The hijacker, you know, the plane was forced down in Athens, and the passengers all got off there. So Jack Holland thought, okay, while I'm here, I might as well check out this museum.
While I'm here, coincidentally.
Is it? Yeah. And so he said, well, so sure enough, there was this museum, and sure enough, there was this curator, and sure enough, the curator said, oh yeah, I have this volume of by Plato that you might be interested in. He was thumbed through the translation, and the words that you know, thwack, you know, kind of like a light bulb moment went on for him that fulfilled the Dalai Lama's suggestion / prediction was, he is not on my wavelength. And I've mulled that over many years off and on, and the conclusion I get is, there's really, you know, and particularly now with course jargon, if you will, I would suggest that there's really only two wavelengths. There's really the wavelength of the Holy Spirit's curriculum of forgiveness, and then there's the spectrum, really, of the ego's incredible diversity of ideas and thoughts and experiences that have to do with the idea of that sin is real and innocence is has been lost, if it ever was, kind of thing. And so, you know, really the knot on the wavelength really suggests that if we choose the teacher of kindness, we choose the teacher of forgiveness, and that in truth we're all innocent of anything that could have possibly happened in a dream world of space and time, then we are in that realm, in the mind, immune and exempt and free of influence from anything in the world, and whether it be, you know, propaganda from another country or from another thought system, shall we say. So anyway, and I just realized that we run out of time. So if anybody's interested in the conversation I had with Gary and Cindy, Gary Renard, Cindy Laura Renard, I posted that on acimblog.com, and along with a bunch of other stuff. And I am soon going to catch up on all recordings, Lynn, for our wonderful Saturday morning conversations. As well as a few others. So anyway, and you can find all that kind of stuff there. So thank you, Lynn, as always, and everyone who's listening, and have a great week.
So, all right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and I love you so much. Likewise. So grateful for you, and what fun we have. Anyway, I'll talk to you next week.
Have a great one.
All right. Bye-bye.